So after last week's somewhat depressing sermon, I decided we would talk about happiness this week. It may not go as planned, but we're going to talk about it. I mean, we all do seek it. It's part of our human makeup and constitution. Everybody wants to be happy, no matter who you are. As Blaise Pascal once wrote, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and the others avoiding it, it's the same desire for both, attended with different views. They will never the will never takes the least step but to this object of happiness. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves." End quote. We pursue and we work and we purchase and we attempt to numb, all in hopes that we will find this seemingly elusive reality of happiness. It's clearly elusive, or we wouldn't be so miserable. I mean, Sheryl Crow pointed it out to us, didn't she? You know, if it makes you happy, then why are you so sad? I mean, you know this reality. You remember those things that you used to maybe wish for and even pray for. You know, if this one thing would change, if we could go from an apartment to a home, if I could go from single to being married, if this would happen, then I would be happy. And then God answered those prayers. And you've been content ever since. But next time, probably. I mean, that's what we always say, isn't it? And the author of Ecclesiastes does want to help us. He is like you. He saw that all was vanity, but he just couldn't seem to buy it. That can't be right. It didn't sit right with him. So he said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put everything to the test." He was going to be the exception to the apparent rule that life is vanity and a futility. He was going to be that one lottery winner that doesn't destroy his life with instant wealth. He was going to be that one famous person who, after all the celebrity, didn't feel alone and empty at night. He was going to explore all the pleasures of life and be that one person that did not wake up with that empty, sinking feeling in the morning. In this, he is just like us. We all believe somehow that we are the exception to the rule. And even if the rule keeps slapping us upside the head, we keep saying, "Well, next time, somehow it will work." The preacher of Ecclesiastes is ready to disabuse you of that notion this morning, if you will let him, but also to offer you a different way forward, a way of being in exchange for what you're losing. And he is the perfect candidate for it, because in this way, he is not at all like us. So he's like us in his quest that he thinks, well, there's got to be more than just vanity. He's not like us in the fact that when he goes on this quest, he has all the power to seemingly accomplish overcoming the vanity of this life. Hopefully you heard it even as it was being read this morning. Of all the kings of Israel, there was never any wealthier. Of all the kings of Israel, there was never any wiser. Of all the kings of Israel, there was never any with more notoriety. He literally was an international celebrity. He has all the tools of time and power and wealth at his disposal to go on this quest. And so for us who say, you know, there is this quest, but if I just had a little more money, then I'd be happy. I mean, that vacation was great, but if we could have stayed at the nicer hotel next door, you know, next time, then the vacation would be better. But we just don't have all the means or the ability or the power or the celebrity to accomplish those things, so we still hold out hope. And the hope is, well, maybe someday I will gain those things, and then I can gain this elusive happiness. Well, Kohelet has all of those things at his disposal, and he is ready to use them in this quest and this search for happiness. With all of these at the ready, he climbs to the top of the mountain to see what he could find there, and he's reporting back to us this morning with what he found when he got to the top and had it all. And so let's hear his report. First thing I want us to see is all of the tools in the quest for happiness, or at least all of the means. He begins, you'll notice, in our text with wisdom. And of course, as a wisdom teacher, that seems like a completely reasonable place to begin. And yet, he says the wisdom test fails immediately because it's like chasing the wind. He says there's no profit even to wisdom. And we think, well, how can that be? And he says, well, because the wiser you get, the more vexation and sorrow you have. It makes you miserable to know about this life. And we say, well, why is that? In verse 15, there's that amazing parable or proverb, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. He says, all the wisdom in the world cannot unbend this bent world. All the wisdom in the world cannot make something be there that isn't there. He says, there is no gain, and you can't count if there's nothing. Well, how much money do you have? I don't have any. Well, let's count it up. He says, that's what like the world. He said, you can't count what's lacking. And therefore, the more you know about the world, the more wisdom you have, the more you see that there is no changing the circumstance, and the greater your sorrow and your vexation are. Hemingway says, happiness in intelligent people is the rarest thing I know. Very similar to what is being said by Kohelet. So he says, well, let's try a different tack. If sadness is what comes from wisdom, let's just do a 180 and we will seek pleasure. Surely, let's just kind of, turn off our brains, just have a good time, seek the things that are kind of at our baser level, the things that will bring us some sort of enjoyment without having to think too much about everything. And he tried it all. He says he began with comedy, with laughter. And he said, but laughing in this world is a sort of madness. I mean, we've all seen it, whether in the national spotlight, just as the reality of the tears of the clown. Most comedians will acknowledge that they are quite depressed people. We saw it very clearly in the life and death of Robin Williams, taking his life at his own hand. He wrote these words, I think the saddest people always try their hardest to make people happy because they know what it's like to feel absolutely worthless. And they don't want anyone else to feel like that. Maybe some of you remember when Louis C.K. was on Conan about a year and a half ago. He made all kinds of national news because he said out loud what none of us wants to talk about. And he was doing it, in a somewhat lighthearted and yet very somber, somewhat lighthearted manner. But the conclusion was very somber. And it, took off like wildfire, mainly because he made fun of cell phones. And there was a lot of tech people who wanted to, react to that. But he said these words. You need to build an ability to just be yourself and not be doing something. And that's what these phones are taking away, is the ability to just sit there. That's being a person, because underneath everything in your life, there is that thing. That empty, forever empty. That knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're all alone. It's down there. And sometimes when things clear away and you're not watching anything and you're in your car and you start going, oh no, there it comes, that I'm alone, it starts to visit on you just the sadness. Life is tremendously sad just by being in it. End quote. So he says, in laughter I found no remedy, and so I took pleasure in the finer things in life and maybe something that would numb a little bit of the pain. And he pursues wine. And while hard to get at exactly what he's going here, he says two things. First, he says he pursues it in such a way where he did not leave off the project of what he was doing. He said, I pursued wine, and yet the whole time my wisdom was before me. I was doing these things, if you will, for your sake. I wasn't just doing it as a complete lush or someone who was completely numbing out, but he says, I did both pursue wine in the sophisticated kind of connoisseur way, and I also grasped after folly to see if that would be the way forward. So he drank, like a sommelier and like a frat boy, and he says both of them were meaningless. And so he says, I just started undertaking projects, some of these vanity projects, maybe something that would make me feel better about myself. And so I began to kind of excavate the whole kingdom and really to build out things that would really make, some sort of lasting profit and give me pleasure. And so he builds houses, even God's house, and plants vineyards and a garden and parks. And it says he planted trees with every sort of fruit. And he even set up his own irrigation system of these pools, the pools of Solomon, which still exist today, that then watered the land to where you didn't have to ship water in constantly and it could remain lush. So that he pursued after that wealth, silver and gold and even the kingdoms and provinces of others. And the Bible tells us that in Solomon's time, the kingdom was so wealthy that silver was counted as nothing. That they're just like, oh, that's silver. It's like pennies. We don't care about that. We can imagine having that kind of wealth. And he says, with that wealth, he purchased singers, both men and women. You know, if you don't have Spotify and you want to listen to music in his time, you know, you don't just get to get your, cell phone out or, even back in our older generation, there was no record player. So he just bought the band. And he's like, I like your music. I'll have you. And so he has the music at the ready. He has entertainment that will hopefully soothe something deep in him. And beyond that, he pursues all manner of sexual pleasures. We learn from the Bible he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. What he calls here in the text, the delight of the children of man. But even that couldn't do it. And we know these things are unsatisfying, and some of how we as a culture go about monetizing them shows it. I mean, the industry of pornography makes millions by tapping into this reality of dissatisfaction, knowing that there will never be enough for you to look at and see till you'll be done with it all and say, now I'm satisfied. And when he surveys the whole thing in verse 11, he stacks up every key word that he's used in the book this far for his final evaluation. He says, all of my toil, all of it was vanity, all of it was striving after the wind. There was no gain under the sun. All of these pursuits in the realm of pleasure had no lasting benefit. All is hevel. But it's odd. I mean, he says that, but we don't believe it. We don't really believe what he's saying. He's not the first person that you've heard say this or try to tell you this. And the dangers, of course, is you're going to sit here this morning and hear it, and then you're going to go out this afternoon and try to beat the system one more time. We always think that we would be content and happy only if we had access to this or that sort of pleasure or gain. And it doesn't matter how many people tell us otherwise, including the teacher here in Ecclesiastes, we are bent not to believe them. Brad Pitt saw this quite well in his interview, when he's been interviewed for the famous film The Fight Club. The interviewer asked him to play devil's advocate. What is the point that we're missing? And Brad Pitt responds, the point is, the question has to be asked, what track are we on? I mean, Tyler starts out in the movie saying, man, I know all these things are supposed to seem important to us, the car, the condo, our versions of success. But if that's the case, why is the general feeling out there reflecting more impotence and isolation and desperation and loneliness? If you ask me, I say, toss all this. We've got to find something else. Because all I know is that at this point in time, we are heading for a dead end, a numbing of the soul, a complete atrophy of the spiritual being, and I don't want that. So the interviewer responds, so if we're heading toward this kind of existential dead end as a society, what do you think should happen? Because, I mean, surely, if someone's going to have the answer, it's going to be Brad Pitt. And he responds, hey man, I don't have those answers yet. Listen to this. The emphasis now is on success and personal gain. And I'm sitting in it. And I'm telling you, that's not it. Whether you want to listen to me or not, and I say that to the reader, that's not it. Fascinating. Solomon even says in verse 12, what can the king who comes after me do? Says he can't do anything. I have done it all. He's never going to outstrip the quest that I just went on. So there's nothing left to be said on this topic. It's all vanity. Whether we want to listen to it or not, he says, this is not it. So he takes another shot at wisdom. He says, okay, it didn't work the first time, but pleasure didn't work. So back to wisdom. There's got to be something there. And he says, you know, the fact is wisdom is better than folly, relatively. He says it's like this, you know, walking around in the dark is not to be preferred over to walking around with the lights on. Well, why? Well, because you'll stub your toe and there's huge, you know, if there's huge pits in the field, you'll fall in them. So clearly there's a relative benefit that you're just not walking through life as a complete ignoramus. There is wisdom to be found in, you know, getting up and going to work in the morning and doing the right thing at the right time and not breaking every possible law. You know, there are things that fools do that make their whole life just full of unnecessary trouble. He says in that way, sure, wisdom is to be preferred over folly. It has an advantage. You can see things. It also has a disadvantage. You can see things. Its disadvantage is you can see what is there and you can't fix it. You can't do anything about it. You can just know it. And you can also see that things don't always work out the way they're supposed to. The wise man will die just like the fool. That they will both end up with the same exact outcome. So what was the benefit of all of my wisdom if both of us die and there is no lasting gain to be had? There are some who do it right and it goes all wrong. And there are some who do it all wrong and things are fine. We say things like, cheaters never prosper, unless you're the Patriots or the Astros. Then it's very lucrative. But you see this, I mean, I remember being on one of the hiking trips with the college students and having a conversation with a few young ladies who were saying, you know, we want to live a godly life, but what's interesting is when you try to live a godly life, all the young men in the college group date all of these frivolous, silly girls and want nothing to do with us. And so what's the point of being wise if it doesn't, you know, we would like to be also desirous. We want to get married, and yet there doesn't seem to be any fruit in this particular pursuit. He simply just says, look, the wise and the fool always meet at the graveyard. It's the great equalizer. At the end, there is no huge benefit. You know, you've seen those T-shirts. You know, my parents went to Hawaii and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. And Kohelet says, I lived a life of wisdom and all I got was this lousy coffin, just like the fool next to me at the graveyard. Notice his conclusion. So I hated life. It says it grieved me because I could see what was crooked was never going to be made straight. What was lacking was never going to be counted. There is no happiness to be found. And so he throws himself into his work. He's dying for something to be lasting. And so he thinks, maybe my labors will outlive me. And so while my wisdom will die with me, these wise things I do, these labors, these vanity projects, they will continue. And he says, I saw that that was vanity too. This is mainly vanity because you work and you work and you leave them to another and you have no idea. Is he going to be wise or is he going to be a fool? Someone else will take over your project and you have no control over what they do with it. Maybe some of you have seen the Sagrada Familia, the cathedral in Barcelona by Gaudi. It started 150 years ago. It is a magnificent building, very unique. But he left the plans to be built out, and it's been those in Barcelona are building it out. It should be finished, I think, in 2023, 2033, something to that effect. But you see the beginning of the project, and it is just gorgeous. And then you see, you know, the artists that took over, like in the 1980s, and you're like, oh man, like this cathedral, you're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Left turn over here, you know. You just think like, poor Gaudi, you know, he left these instructions, he had this project, he has this huge, beautiful vision, and no control once he's gone. Even your works can't maintain a name for you. I mean, you'll notice statistically, second generation businesses fail at a rate of 60%. By the third generation, only 10% of family businesses still exist. Who knows whether the one who comes after you will be wise or a fool or have any interest at all in what you are doing. And I really hope my grandmother's not listening to this sermon in the future. If you are a grandmother, I'm sorry now. My grandmother collected precious moments our whole life. Loves precious moments. I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of precious moments everywhere. And one of the things she's really excited to give to us is these precious moments, which I'm going to be extremely grateful for. There's one grandchild who's a total ingrate and, you know, could care less about those precious moments. And they won't value them the same way she values them. I may or may not. I'm not sure yet. But so much of her life, she got these for every Christmas and every birthday I can remember growing up. And guess what? Her grandkids are not going to appreciate them. Her great-grandkids probably won't even have them anymore. So you work and you sweat and you build. But once you leave, you are no longer master over your stuff. And the one who does control it, you have no control over. You can work and work and leave it to someone who won't work at all, but will enjoy all the sweat of your brow. And he says, why then did I work if another rests while I toiled? I mean, Solomon should know. Rehoboam, his son, lost the entire treasury of Israel one generation after Solomon's gone. The whole thing wiped out in one fell swoop. And within several generations, that temple that he labored over, all of its valuables and every stone was carried off to the land of their enemies, piecemeal. It doesn't last. And that breaks him. There's something in him that wants something permanent. There's something built into him by nature that wants something lasting. And when he evaluates everything, he says, there's no gain because there's nothing lasting. Even as the Abbott brothers sing, you know, nothing is good. There's nothing good because nothing lasts. Everything that comes here to pass. And one man's project will become the firewood of the next man that comes along. And here we have the final survey of Solomon, all of his testing, all the impressive works and feats that he's recounted to us. And Hevel is stamped on every single one of them. Maybe you remember the song by U2 when they sang, I have climbed the highest mountains. I've run through the fields only to be with you. I've run, I have crawled, I have scaled these city walls only to be with you. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And this is the part that always affected me as a child that I didn't fully understand. Because as a Christian young man, this seemed really wrong. I believe in the kingdom come. Then all the colors will bleed into one. Bleed into one. Yes, I'm still running. You broke the bonds and you loosed the chains. You carried the cross of my shame. You know I believe it. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You know, he's singing the song of Ecclesiastes, as Jack Higgins writes. When someone interviewed him, he's an author, they said, what would you want to know when you were a boy? He said, what I would have wanted to know, if someone would have told me, is that when you climb the mountain, when you get to the top, there's nothing there. And Kohelet has just climbed to the top of the mountain. He's seen what there's to see. And now he's reporting back to you. He says, you know what's at the top of the mountain? Just wind. It's all sandcastles on the beach. And yet somehow we feel like we're made for something lasting, but we just can't get it. We can't wrap our fingers around it. And we are dying for something that will be permanent, but we can't find it. And the author wants to know, if you're seeking control of any sort in this life where you can make something lasting and permanent, you are grabbing wind. You won't be able to hold on to it. You can try and grab all you want, but there's nothing that you'll be able to take. And he says, and I call for my last witness, death, to take the stand, who will ultimately silence all of those grand illusions. He says, you have no control over your future, your portion. And if you're still listening, he says, there is oddly some good news in this. You don't need any. You don't need any control. You don't need to hang on to your portion. That God has given us a different lot in life. And so, as we close this morning, I want us to see that we need to quit for happiness. There is this good thing. There is something good, he says, in these last verses. You'll notice as he transitions in 24 to 26, that word, or at least the root tov, good, is used four times. And he's answering the four times that he's just said vanity in the verses above. Vanity, vanity, vanity. But he does say, it's good. It's a good thing. There's this good thing that he wants us to grab hold of. He says, this is the best you can have in this life. That God gives good gifts from His hand, and He gives you the ability to enjoy them. He says, that's it. There's God the giver over against man the striver. You can try to gain and grasp and have something lasting. There's nothing there. You'll be empty. Or you can receive from God's hand, and with the moments you have, enjoy what is. He says, that's it. That's man's lot in life. That is where joy and happiness are found. He says, you know what I found was pleasurable about my toil? Just the pleasure in the toil. Just the satisfaction of a job well done. That was it. Anything lasting beyond that? Nope. Just felt good at the end of the day. That's what was enjoyable. So I held on to that. He says, I know I can't change the world or fix it by these means. I can go to my job and make my widgets and sell my insurance. And I know I'm not changing the world irrevocably. And I know at the end of it all, there's going to be nothing lasting. But I got paid for my labors and I did the right thing at the right time. And that was good enough. If that's true, he says, here's what I want you to do in the meantime. If you can't unbend the world, and if you can't make it more profitable than it is, if you can't add anything to that isn't there, there is a portion that is there that has been gifted to you by God just from His hand. There's a banquet in the midst of the curse, and the banquet, according to him, is joy. And he's going to go over this theme 7 times in the book. He's going to keep coming back to this refrain after making us as depressed as possible. He'll say, just have joy. And we think, that seems like a real tall order after everything you've just said. And notice the joys that he wants you to partake in look a lot like the things that he just called vanity 10 verses ago. He's like, wine's vanity. Now he's like, you know what the best thing is? Just have some wine, you know. Enjoy the wine at the end of the day. That's a good thing. But there's a major difference. If you're taking these things as from the hand of God, then you're not trying to make meaning through them or out of them. His whole thing was, I'm pursuing these things as an end in themselves. Will wine give me lasting happiness? If you're seeking it for that, it's never going to make you happy. You both rob God of His glory and you rob the thing of its joy. You'll never find it that way. You'll always be done and be like, I just wish it was more or better, or maybe I can get the better one next time. But if it's just a glass of wine and that's it, if it doesn't need to be infused with more meaning than that, if it doesn't have to make you somebody or give you an identity or give you lasting purpose, guess what? It can just be a good glass of wine and make your heart glad. A sandwich can just be a sandwich if you don't need it to gain or control the world. Your job can just be your job if it doesn't need to be your identity. And in doing it, you can find some measure of joy. God is telling us through this book, you can't leverage anything here to acquire purpose or control. While you were made for that, that ship sailed in the fall. And if you're trying to gain control here, it will not come. But there are plenty of things that can be enjoyed. Which means your relationships can just be relationships. They don't have to be angled for your benefit. Not every relationship you have needs to be networking. You know, it just drives me crazy the way we do things in this culture. Your parties don't have to be infused with how you can get a leg up or a step up or invite the right people. You don't have to show up and start planning the next event. You can just enjoy this one for what it is. We need to stop trying to squeeze more out of the tube of this life than was ever placed there once the fall took place. What you have is God's gift. And the God-given capacity to enjoy them. And both of these things are from His hand. And if there's nothing to gain by them, if you can't use them to gain anything, then notice what you can do. You can just enjoy them. You can just have a life to be lived as opposed to one that needs to be leveraged. Every single day, God drops simple joys down from heaven. The laughter of your child. The loyalty of your dog, you know, the smell of brewing coffee, a sip of red wine, the love of your spouse, the satisfaction of getting something done. And with these gifts, you will also have to accept that there'll be plenty in the world that you can't fix, you can't control, and you can't attain. And sometimes even these gifts will be snatched away in hardship. You will find there are plenty of frustrations that you can't escape, but you must just endure them. And that's okay. Nothing, not everything in this life needs to be fixed, and not everything in this life can be fixed. There's a lot of things that just need to be accepted and received. So if you want joy, and you do, then quit. Stop seeking it and start being content. You may ask, with what? Well, start with your breakfast. This moment, your children, your job. Stop waiting for the right place and the right people at the right time. It's never going to come. Many of you have seen, and I often recommend, the movie Groundhog Day. And it drives this point home. I mean, I really do think it's a commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes. You know the story. Phil Connors, played by Bill Murray, unquestionably the greatest actor of our day, is stuck in Punxsutawney, where he is reliving Groundhog Day, February 2nd, every day for what seems like an endless amount of time. And during that time, when he realizes after a while, like, look, this day is not changing, I can't get out, he tries all the same old tropes. He goes for hedonism. I mean, the scene where he's just gorging himself in the diner. When hedonism doesn't work, when that runs its course, he tries greed. And of course, that doesn't work. You've got to start all over the next day. And finally, he, takes a sophisticated approach. I will try knowledge. I will try wisdom. Surely that is better. And that doesn't work either. So instead, he just decides to live every day for what it is, to start serving others, to be content with what he has. And the final, kind of climactic scene in the film is when he looks into his now, lover's eyes. He says, I don't know what will happen tomorrow. All I know is I'm happy right now. And it requires him to give up trying to control and hold a future that he can't know and he can't control and he can't guess, and just accept the gifts that are before him in the moment. You have all the permission in the world to do so according to the Bible. And not just the gifts of the day, but even more so now that you have the gift of God's Son. This text hints to us about what the gospel will eventually scream to us, is that we were made for more. We are dying for something permanent. We just can't gain it on our own. And it's even shown to us in this text. Maybe you heard it in the reading. There is Solomon, David's greater son, with all wealth and wisdom. And he says, I applied my knowledge and my power to create. And what did he create? He creates this garden with trees of every sort of fruit that is watered by its own pools. He puts before us what he calls enclosures in the text, which parks, it's translated in your text, which is the word for paradise. He makes or attempts to make a paradise on earth, and it does not work. You cannot go back to Eden. You can't fix the problems that we have here. We tried that, we failed, and that effort is futile. It is chasing the wind, and it will elude you. Notice in verse 11, he considers all the works of his hands, and instead of hearing what we hear God say, all very good, he says it's all vanity. Solomon couldn't get it done by toil. But one greater than Solomon has come, and for the joy that was set before him, he toiled for us, joined our vanity with us, and entered into our final destiny of death on our behalf. And as he was doing so, to one who was hanging next to him, who had labored not at all, not in the right way, he told that one, today you will be with me in paradise. You can't make a garden that will last. You can't create a paradise that will be lasting. So give up. What does the guy do? He says, we deserve what we're getting. He doesn't deserve it. And Jesus says, today, you get it all. You have done nothing and you will gain everything. To him who does not work but believes, to him, God will give all of the good gifts and graces that have been earned by Christ Jesus. You see, the reason this is good news is that so much of your striving and so much of your unhappiness is you're trying to grasp something you'll never get. But what if it was already given to you? And what is it you want? A name? I mean, what if your life is hidden in the one whose name is above every name? And he's making for you a lasting name that no one can blot out. You want wealth? He has for you a kingdom where moth and rust can never destroy. And it's given to you as pure grace. You want to be loved? He offers it to you freely before you did anything to earn or deserve it. And he promises that you cannot lose it because there was nothing you ever did to gain it. And with those realities, he says, since there's nothing left to be done and nothing left to be gained, I give you permission to just live. And as you live, enjoy the good graces that I give you with the frustrations, with the brokenness of this life, the best you can do. Find joy in the simple gifts that have come from God's hand with the ability that He grants by His grace to enjoy them. May we do so for His name and for our own happiness. Let's pray.